Well, as we trailed it in the Weekly Worker, I'm gonna inevitably concentrate on the unfolding events in Rafah, in particular. I mean, from my angle, just looking at the Israeli operation, the fact that we seem to be reaching the sort of final conclusion that we are. I'm not saying that we've seen the end of military operations, but clearly events are rapidly moving towards a horrendous, horrendous outcome. It did strike me that, well, this is how things were going to go. I.e., if we look at Israel, it invaded Gaza in the north, told people to evacuate Gaza City and go towards Khan Yunis. And it just seemed obvious, at least in my mind, what they were aiming for. And that is, and I'll discuss that in a little while. Either Egypt opening the border or forcing the Palestinians to break through themselves, simply on the basis that human beings will tend to want to keep themselves alive. So having, denied people food, sanitation, medicine, clean water. Not just since October the 7th, but in particular since October the 7th, people will become desperate, and here we are. So I'll discuss, possible outcomes, but it does seem disastrous. Okay, just a few points. According to the figures that I've read, in terms of Rafah, which is on the border between Gaza and the Sinai, i.e., Gaza and Egypt, there are now 1.4 million people packed in. I think the town's original population was something like 30,000. I mean, you've seen, along with me, I suppose, the satellite pictures of just a sort of sea of tents. We also have figures saying that as a result of bombing, but also it has to be said, deliberate demolition, something like 80% of the buildings to the north of Rafah are either damaged or completely destroyed. In other words, we're not in a position of where people can simply be told, well, go home to the north, because their homes don't exist. And we'll leave aside sanitation, we'll leave aside hospitals, we'll leave aside food. So that's the situation that we find ourselves in. So, not surprisingly, the United Nations has been talking about a disaster, a bloodbath, after all, because what Netanyahu, I think, announced last week, but it now seems to be giving the go-ahead, is the final assault. And usually that follows a pattern of, first of all, airstrikes. Artillery, missiles, and then you send the tanks and the infantry in. Well, we're not dealing with, a conventional battle with, on the one side, there's Hamas, neatly lined up, ready to get massacred, and the Israeli Defense Forces. What we're dealing with is Hamas, of course, understandably, will immerse itself in the Palestinian masses. This isn't an organization that's separate from the masses. Hasn't got the same ideology of Mao's People's Liberation Army, but famously, he talked, about guerrillas swimming like fish in a sea, and that's a situation with Hamas. So they're not easily picked out. You can't just say we drop a bomb and we only get Hamas. Quite the opposite, and that's what the UN is warning about. That if you drop a bomb, given how tightly packed people are, given that Hamas fighters will be amongst this 1.4 million, the death toll, just in military from military attacks, looks like it will be horrendous. And my understanding is, from reading last night, that the death toll, total death toll now, this is recorded deaths, have exceeded now 28,000. And of course, that doesn't include dead bodies under concrete and all the rest of it. I've mentioned food. The sickening thing about food, of course, is that there is food there. I'm not talking about in Gaza, but we're talking about near Gaza. So just to the north of Gaza, there's food that's been delivered by Turkey that's sufficient to feed 1.1 million people. And what we've seen is week after week after week, Israel blocking the delivery of this food. And of course, I don't know if you've listened to radio or TV broadcasts when you get a slightly ignorant reporter sitting there in London or wherever it happens to be, and talking about, well, it's warm over there in Gaza. Well, it ain't. It's winter in Gaza, just like it's winter here. And of course, what happens in that part of the world is winter coincides with rain. So the conditions are perfect for disease, and as I've said before, people don't tend to die directly of hunger. They tend to get hung more hungry and more hungry and more hungry, and go down with disease because of the conditions that they're in. They're tightly packed. There's no sanitation. But talking about food, there's food there that's not only being blocked. We also have Israeli protesters, on border posts, demanding that food isn't sent in, blocking food supplies, the little food supplies that are coming via Israel. So people, not surprisingly, resorting to eating grass just to fill their bellies, and grinding up animal feed. So in other words, rather than, letting your kids scream out from hunger, you feed them anything that you happen to have available. And that's an indication of where we stand at the present time. Having mentioned Egypt, you can see satellite photographs and reports of what's going on. The Sinai is one of those areas of Egypt that is particularly sensitive because there's been some sort of guerrilla struggles taking place there. I mean, I've actually visited Egypt. This is before the overthrow of Mubarak. And when I visited, tourists had been a target, and it was a crazy society. I mean, to travel, for example, from Cairo to the Aswan Dam in the south, you had to go in convoys. Every street corner in the cities had armed, units with machine guns. Well, that is the sort of regime that exists in the Sinai. So it's not somewhere reporters can casually turn up to and get a car to the border and take photographs and take film and interview people. But what we can see is renewed fortification. So there's a wall that goes up, I think it's 6 meters high. I'm not really sure about meters and all that, but I think 6 meters high. And it also goes deep into the ground, and that's to block off potential tunnel operations. And on top of that wall, we have barbed wire. And now what's happening is Egypt is digging a huge trench its side of the border. And indeed, it's interesting to note that Israel Netanyahu is talking about the possibility of Israel itself inserting itself along the border between Egypt and Gaza and establishing an occupied zone there. So what the object is, as I said, I don't know, but certainly in the immediate aftermath of October the 7th, there were those Israeli politicians, and we're talking about Israeli politicians from within Netanyahu's coalition. So it's Likud and parties to the right of Likud, and various ministers, not just MPs, Knesset members, who were talking about expelling either all the Gazan population over the border, or at least a substantial chunk of the population over the border. And of course, what we have, as I've already indicated, is Egypt building in a way that prevents that. And of course, Sisi, the former army top, now elected, I say that in inverted commas, not a free election by any chalk. He's saying we will not let in the Palestinians. They've taken in several thousand people who've been injured and put them into Egyptian hospitals. But they're insisting that if Israel, for example, used its undoubted military superiority to break through this Egyptian wall and simply push his people, or maybe people, combine being pushed and running over the border. Not only do we have the possibility of Egyptian forces firing, and indeed, Egyptian forces are under instruction that if they see anybody moving in no man's land, between the Gazan border and Egyptian, how should I put it, positions, their people are under instructions to shoot. And what we have at the moment is not only, work, undergoing work of a huge, huge trench. I don't know how deep it is. All I know is from the satellite pictures how long it is and how wide it is. But we also have 40 Egyptian tanks sent to the border between Gaza and the Sinai. So Israel could breach at that wall. I don't know, how stiff Egyptian opposition would be, but if Israel decided to do that, it could do that. But Egypt is threatening that if that happens, it's not only a question that people might be met with tank shells and bullets, but Egypt would rescind its treaty with Israel, its peace treaty with Israel. I think the peace treaty, yeah, there you are. It was the 1979 peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. That doesn't mean that there would be war, but I think it would mean that neither would there be peace It's one of those sort of type situations. And of course, this would be much to the displeasure of the Americans, who, of course, brokered this treaty. And of course, it would mean, a diplomatic disaster as far as the US hegemon is concerned. And of course, we then have the unanswered question of what else happens in Egypt, because it should be stressed that what we're dealing with here is something that isn't the equivalent of what's going on, for example, over the English Channel, let alone the US Mexico border. That if we look at the Egyptian masses, they are going to be, in complete solidarity and complete sympathy with the Palestinians. So these aren't people, that who will be viewed on the streets of Cairo or Alexandria as outsiders, of people who ought to be kept out. And indeed, if you look at Egypt, it's had a history of taking in refugees from Sudan. It had a civil war that's been on and off. It's taken people in from Yemen. But from Sisi's point of view, what he's saying is that, first of all, he doesn't want to ruin the chances of Palestinian statehood, because obviously, if Gaza is evacuated and people are dumped in the Sinai, that means part of the historic mandate, Palestine, has been cleared of Palestinians, much in the way that what is now officially Israel was cleared, with 1948. But also, Sisi is worried about introducing instability, because the idea that that Israel dumps 2.4 or whatever the particular figure happens to be million people in the Sinai, okay, then the UN would be supplying tents and food and water and doctors. But also, what would happen is resistance would continue. The idea that people stop resisting isn't true, and every general, every politician knows it. So Egypt actually, of course, fears that instead of resistance happening from Gaza, it would happen from the Sinai, and Israel would respond in the same way that it's done to resistance from Gaza, except it would be bombing targets in Sinai. So what does Egypt do under those circumstances? Simply let its territory be hit by missiles and aircraft. And also, the key thing to me is to understand the politics. As I said, if you take Sisi, he won the last election. Well, no surprise, sort of type idea. It was fixed. The last so-called free elections in Egypt, both parliamentary and presidential, of course, returned Islamicists, and specifically a Muslim Brotherhood president. And as we're told in the press, and it's true, if you look at Hamas, it's a branch of, an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. And what happens? The Muslim Brotherhood hasn't gone away in Egypt. Yes, lots of their leaders are in prison. Some of them have been executed. But the Muslim Brotherhood, according to all reports, is active and is growing in strength. What do they do under circumstances, either where Egyptian troops start shooting down their brothers and sisters who are starving? What happens on the streets of Cairo? What happens on the streets of Alexandria and other Egyptian cities and towns? Does the Muslim Brotherhood shrug its shoulders? Remember, Egypt fought Israel in 1948, and there was a specific Muslim Brotherhood mobilization in 48 to defend the Palestinians. So the fellow feeling is absolutely still there. And when there were demonstrations recently over Israel and its invasion of Gaza, this was a government-sponsored demonstration. It very quickly got out of hand, and it manifested itself as a Muslim Brotherhood demonstration. And as a result of that, we saw examples of not only the police using tear gas, but other forms of oppression. And what's true for Egypt is, of course, true for other countries in the region, Jordan, Syria, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states. I don't want to go into them, I don't know enough. But the point would be about Egypt is it shares a border of where it looks at least possible millions of people will either be dying or being expelled from. That makes it of particular importance, and not least the fact that, of course, that Egypt is by far and away the most populous Arab country by a long, long way. So it's the most important Arab country. And I think I would be right to say that in terms of American subsidies, it's one of the most subsidized countries, in terms of American foreign policy, a long way behind Israel. But nonetheless, I think it gets something like $1 billion dollars of aid. And of course, what's happened in Egypt is not only, I mean, I haven't got the figures at hand, but one wouldn't be surprised if tourism, which is absolutely vital for the Egyptian economy, has fallen off somewhat. And the other sort of lifeline in terms of the very fragile Egyptian economy is, of course, the Suez Canal. And we all know about shipping being hit in the Red Sea and therefore being diverted around South Africa. That means a loss of revenue to the Suez Canal Company and therefore the coffers of the Egyptian state. So what happens? I mean, I don't know. I mean, one thing I don't think that's going to happen is that Netanyahu is going to order the evacuation of the Gazan population into Israel. That isn't going to happen. He's not wanting refugee camps in Israel. Is he going to then transport them all the way to the border, all the way up to the border, in terms of the West Bank? No, that doesn't work either. They want Palestinians out of the West Bank, not more Palestinians on the West Bank. So there is Jordan. Will Jordan take kindly to more Palestinian refugees? Hardly. So what happens? And that's why, I mean, I literally don't know the answer, and I don't think any of us here know the answer. Maybe the answer is known in Netanyahu's mind, but he isn't a completely free actor. Not only is he head of a coalition, he's head of a war cabinet, but he's also reliant on US aid. And we're not just talking about the $3 billion that I understand that goes from Israel to Israel from the United States. More importantly than that, the Israeli war machine relies on continuous US supplies. And it is worth noting, however pathetic, and it is pathetic, the Biden administration has been, while those bombs, while those bullets, while those tank parts, aircraft parts continue to be flown to Israel, Biden's language has got more, what would you call it? Strident? That's not really the right word, but desperate? I don't know. Either way, there is speculation in the press today about relations between the Biden administration and Netanyahu not only being strained, but perhaps reaching a breaking point. I don't know. But how would it go down in the United States in terms of there you are, people start dying, not just in their thousands, but in their tens of thousands. I mean, you can ask the question, and it's perfectly legitimate, and we'll come to that. Well, people have the choice to vote for another presidential candidate. But looking at Trump, he hardly serves as, an opponent of ethnic cleansing in Israel. Quite the opposite. He was quite prepared to look at Netanyahu annexing various chunks of the West Bank of Palestine when he was president. So we have US warnings as well as UN warnings. And the last article that I read on this whole question, again, it's all speculative. I don't think anyone knows, as I said, was on in the New York Times, which was talking about the possibility of Israel making a breach in the wall and simply letting Palestinians cross over. So it looks to me, at least, that we're in conditions of either genocide or a second Nakba, and maybe it amounts to both, i.e., mass deaths and a mass expulsion coincides. So just horrendous. Meanwhile, we have the crocodile tears, and you have to say it is crocodile tears from Biden, Cameron, and other such politicians. Why? Because aid keeps going to Israel, weapons keep going to Israel. So we have talk of a two-state solution, but it's clearly a nonsense. I mean, we'll leave aside Gaza for the moment. All you need to say is on the West Bank, leaving aside the annexed East Jerusalem, what you have is 400,000 settlers with Palestinian areas reduced to what is, to all intents and purposes, I was going to say the word Bantustans, but in reality, I suppose they, if you want to draw an analogy or use something perhaps that's slightly more accurate now, they more closely resemble Indian reservations in the United States. And the reason why I hesitated when it came to Bantustans is, of course, in South Africa, you had a colonial settler regime that relied on Bantustans to supply labor to the economy. So, yeah, every black person was designated a native of X, Y, or Z. And okay, they lived in barrack room conditions while they worked, but they meant to have had a homeland. But the point would be that definitively since October the 7th, but as a, how should I put it, as a model, as a form of settler colonialism, Israel has never relied on Palestinian labor. Palestinian labor's been present, of course. Not least the Israeli Arab population, the 20% in Israel proper. But it precisely was designed by the Zionists, by Herzl and others, to exclude the Arabs. And that's been the model. And so, therefore, that's why I would choose, if I wanted to use an analogy, and again, everything's specific, everything has to be. Analyze concretely, but if we wanted to use an analogy, a reservation is closer to the mark. Okay, very quickly, what's the solution? Well, you get those comrades on the left who say a one-state solution, and my reply to that, well, is how? At the moment, both in Gaza. And on the West Bank and in Israel proper, clearly the Palestinians are in no position whatsoever to impose their will. And then you get the comrades, and quite rightly, I think, by the way, that what is needed, as I've indicated, is action elsewhere in the region. So in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Syria, Saudi Arabia, crucially, in Egypt. And the problem I have with that is quite straightforward, is while there was a bourgeois or a capitalist solution, and we can criticize it in South Africa, there you are, with the help of the Soviet Union, the frontline states, Cuba, but crucially, through the efforts of the black masses themselves, you could get rid of apartheid. Okay, it didn't go through revolution, it wasn't overthrown, it was negotiated, but we don't have apartheid today. Okay, we have more inequality today, but we don't have apartheid. If you have action in the region of a similar sort to South Africa, and again, the analogy doesn't really work. The Soviet Union's no longer there. The frontline states aren't the same. And what I know, of course, with apartheid, it was America and the West eventually what did it. Either way, the point would be that if you look at the Israeli masses, and I'm talking about the working class, well, they look kindly on a situation of where the poles of oppression are reversed. They can be promised equal rights, but you do note with the PLO and with al-Fatah and with the comrades on the left, what they promise the Israelis, the Israeli Jews, the Hebrew nation, call it whatever you will, is not equal national rights. In the formulation, what they offer is equal religious rights. So Christians, Jews, Muslims, all have equal rights. So they can go and pray, they can be married how they choose, but they don't have national rights because national rights would include something, not only on the level of some sort of autonomy, but at least in the classic Marxist tradition, the possibility of a separation up to and including the right to separate. How you draw the borders, that's a different question, but borders could be drawn. And the problem is, if you don't have that, are the Israeli masses, is the Israeli working class going to resist? Is it going to welcome such a conclusion? No, it's going to resist and it's not going to welcome such a conclusion. And that's why, in terms of what needs to be raised now, not as an immediate demand, but certainly as a propaganda demand, is the question of socialism. It needs to be something where the Israeli working class gains as opposed to loses. If you were dealing with a South African situation where whites made up what, I don't know, what was the percentage? 10%, 15%, whatever the percentage was within Palestine. What we're talking about is roughly 50-50. So we're not dealing with any comparable. And of course, Israel is armed to the teeth. And of course, it's backed, at least at the moment, by the world hegemon. Either way, I don't think a one-state solution is viable. Certainly not with the efforts, as you've, at least I've been reading in Socialist Worker. By their own efforts, they can secure liberation. It's just not true of the Palestinians. It's to kid oneself. Okay, then you get the comrades who put forward the two-state solution, which is what Cameron is going on about, what Joe Biden is going on about. Well, in my view, Biden, Cameron, and their predecessors are going on about a two-state solution in a completely cynical fashion. They know it's not going to happen. And all they're demanding from Netanyahu is he pays lip service to it, because that's all the Israeli prime ministers and Israeli coalitions have done over the years. Meanwhile, they planted governments of all colors, all stripes. They planted colonists on the West Bank. They did plant colonists in Gaza, but thought it was a little bit crazy. given the numbers involved, and abandoned that. But as I say, there are 400,000 FAKs on the ground in the West Bank, excluding East Jerusalem. It will not happen. What's different, as I said, about Netanyahu is he makes no pretense about it, much to the annoyance of Cameron and much to the annoyance of Biden and others in his administration. Okay, let's move on. This is back to Britain, but it's related, and that's the victory of Dr. David Miller in a employment tribunal. I think everyone here will know what was involved in the case. David Miller was sacked by Bristol University. This is after he was found innocent of breaking his terms of employment with the university, but after I think it was the campaign against anti-Semitism, but a whole campaign that was conducted by the establishment, part of the witch hunt in and beyond the Labour Party around the Corbyn leadership. He was one of the victims of that, after the inevitable complaints of Zionists, and it needs to be said Zionist students, not Jewish students, Zionist students who found his views objectionable. Well, I'm sorry. My own take on this is, being an advocate of free speech, if I was at university, which is meant to have a robust culture of intellectual inquiry and debate, and I sat there in a history seminar, I would expect almost certainly to find the lecturer, with very few exceptions, putting forward something that I not only found that I disagreed with, but actually, I would find it objectionable. And the same would apply if I went to something on economics, because my view is that wage labor is an abomination. It's not a natural product. And I could go and sit there, in terms of, I suspect, at least a good percentage of courses when it came, at least in the olden days, but still a few cases when it comes to biology. Certainly in the old days. Anyway, the point I'm making is that Bristol University decided that it couldn't take the heat. It got rid of him. And what we've had isn't action by the UCU, the University's College Union, didn't stand by him. It wasn't as a result of strike action. He hasn't been reinstated. The ruling is that Bristol University was wrong to sack him, and my understanding is on the basis of what is called protected characteristics, which is your ideology, your world outlook, your beliefs. So I think that what we have is the courts basically deciding that, along with being Jewish, Christian, a TERF, I don't know what. It's in a position to decide what is legitimate and what is not legitimate. So it's right to celebrate his victory, but this isn't simply a victory for freedom of speech. So I would say myself that, given the clampdown on people expressing their views on Zionism and saying Zionism is a form of racism, people ought to be allowed to say that. But they ought to be allowed to say the exact opposite. There ought to be the right to freedom of speech. That doesn't mean that any lecturer, should be intimidating students. We expect some sort of, standard of behavior. But nonetheless, what comes out of your mouth should be open to examination. Anyway, this is a result of the Equalities Act. And the problem that David Miller has, as I understand it, is that the Employment Tribunal found at least that his approach to this question meant that they reduced damages. That's my reading of it. We've got Mike McNair writing an article on this question for this week's paper. But what I would expect, and I could be wrong here, I would expect under political pressure, Bristol University to appeal on this one. I don't know where you can take the appeal to, but I would expect that they would be aiming, and those behind Bristol University, i.e., the establishment, would be aiming to take it as far as they can. Which means that, is David Miller, who's, whatever compensation he's got, I would suggest he's very much out of pocket. Can he afford to fight this all the way? And should it be up to an employment tribunal that decides what students find offensive or what's legitimate area of debate inside academia? Okay, that's my comment on that one. Let's just move on. What's the time? I've got 42, so I'm moving towards winding up. I try to keep things under an hour. And what I'm going to talk about very, very briefly is AMOC. That's the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. For you and me, the Gulf Stream is part of it. So most of us who were brought up in England or Britain, at least, will know all about the Gulf Stream. You would have been taught it, I would guess, at least I was, in junior school. This is what keeps Britain, a mild, keeps Britain with a mild climate, that we don't freeze in winter and makes things somewhat cooler in the summer. But of course, what we're dealing with isn't just water coming up from the Caribbean. We're dealing with a circulation pattern that delivers warmer water up into the Arctic, but also brings colder water back around the eastern. Yeah, I'm going to get it right. No, from our point of view, the western Atlantic down the American coast, but also transfers waters in Africa. And of course, what's been going on over the last, what, 100 years, but certainly in terms of the 1950s, is that we've got Arctic melting, which is releasing non-salt water into the Atlantic, but cold water. And what happens with this circulation system is that one current gets buried under the other. And what we've had is a new report from the University of Utrecht, which contradicts previous reports that we stand on the cusp of, I'm not going to call it a collapse because this is sloppy talk, but a slowing down, a dangerous slowing down of this circulation, this AMOC circulation system. Collapse is what you'll read in a lot of headlines. And often that's accompanied. I've never watched the damn film. I don't really want to. What's it called? The Day After Tomorrow? I think there are pictures in it, and that's the pictures I've seen with New York completely frozen, and it's meant to happen almost over a weekend. No. But what they're saying, what this report says, is there's a danger of slowdown either from, and this is the perimeters they give it, from 2025, i.e., next year, or 2095, somewhere in that band, i.e., this century, there's a danger of a tipping point. Now, any Marxist will know all about tipping points, quantity into quality. And that is something now that's accepted in all manner of different fields. It used to be a big controversy in biology. It used to be a big controversy in climate science. And you can, I do urge comrades to actually have a look at one of the last chapters of Darwin's Origin, of where he warns his readers against this leap question. Why? Because this is Marxism. He doesn't say that, but he thinks with the leap comes social revolution. And Darwin, as a committed reformist, not radical, a reformist, well, a radical reformist, but not a revolutionary, didn't want a repeat of Chartism. And therefore, you've got a whole chapter in the Origin against the leap. And that was something that was adopted by, I'll call it bourgeois science, when it came to the climate question. But it's something that's been overthrown. So increasingly, scientists have come around to the view that the climate does develop qualitatively. It does go through leaps. You do shift from one pattern to another. So you shift from amok almost overnight in weather pattern terms over into another system. Now, no one knows exactly what the system would be like, but what they're saying is that Britain, for example, would get a lot colder, would get a lot wetter. So you've had people saying, hey, in the midst of global warming, you'd actually get Britain getting colder. And that would apply to West. Well, that's right. Yes, it would. It's not as simple as saying there's global warming and everything just goes up a degree or two. We're talking about climate patterns and therefore changed weather patterns. So, for example, amongst their predictions, which are disputed, I hasten to add, and quite rightly, that's the nature of science, is that there's our figures. Other scientists can come along and say, well, you got this wrong, or your projections are wrong because of this. But they've done a computer projection that has simulated the climate over the last 2,000 years. And they say, as a result of the computer simulation and looking at salt in the Atlantic and various other things that are way beyond me, these are the conclusions we come to. So Britain, yeah, gets a lot more wet and a lot more unpleasant. But also what happens in the Amazon is things dry up and the Amazon jungle basically turns towards something more like the Serengeti. In Africa. Okay, but the point about this is precisely that it would happen quickly. It's not a question of it will happen over the years 2025 to 2095. This will happen bang, sort of type idea. And so what they're saying is we don't know. When this will happen, but if you don't do something urgent now about reversing, and I do mean reversing CO2 and other emissions, this is the sort of thing that can happen. And of course, we also have reports saying that the last year has actually gone over 1.5 degrees. So we're talking about the whole year. Now, of course, Paris wasn't about one year over 1.5, but was the established pattern. But we've breached that particular target to keep things beneath that for one year now. And so if we carry on in that direction, this is what will happen. And it's a chilling prospect because we're talking about not just the Amazon, we're talking about existing agricultural patterns, existing habitat patterns. And of course, we're also talking about a situation of where cities, such as New Orleans, I don't know about London, but I would guess large parts of London, Amsterdam, one can just carry on, end up flooded on a permanent basis. So every high tide, inundation, and therefore have to be either defended by ever higher walls or abandoned, as I think we have Jakarta being abandoned as I speak in Indonesia. Okay. So that's that one. Solution. I think the solution has to lie outside capitalism. I choose my words carefully, simply on the basis of I think because the ruling class know this, or at least sections of the ruling class know, as much as I do, or more, on climate change. Something has to be done. You actually have to overcome the profit drive. You have to overcome production for the sake of production. That does not mean proletarian socialism. That's the most democratic. That's the most humane. That's the logical thing to do. But the working class at the present time is hardly organized, on an international basis, and hasn't readied itself to become the ruling class. So I would expect myself, sections at least of the ruling class, to act. Maybe the army, maybe the secret state, I don't know. But some sort of ruling class action, I would expect. But far from it being democratic, far from it involving some sort of humane outcome, I would expect the opposite. I would expect a horrendous outcome. I mean, I'm calling it climate socialism, but I mean climate socialism in the same sort of way as the German high command in World War I talked about war socialism, Kriegssozialismus. That wasn't heaven, that was hell for the working class. So I'm not putting that forward as something we should support. I think it's something we should be aware of and careful of, because precisely the danger of protest politics is it would be very easily recruited to such a project. It would be very easy to recruit celebrities, the rich, the powerful, to such a regime. Sections of the capitalist class, of course, would resist, but other sections could be recruited to such a project, because either it's a climate breakdown or climate socialism, or from our point of view, proletarian socialism. That's the solution we want. And just in that context, I've talked about the far-sighted nature of some sections of the ruling class. Well, I have to admit that I'm pretty on thin ice when it comes to that, not least when we look at, well, leave aside Rishi Sunak and the drive to extract the maximum amount of North Sea oil and North Sea gas. Look at the Labour Party abandoning its pathetic 25 billion so-called green package. Why pathetic? Precisely because it goes along with the idea that you can be green and pro business. You can be green and pro profit. And within the green economy, there's lots of money to be made. True, true, but anyway, they've abandoned it. And while they say they're still committed to the same aim and aspiration, you shouldn't believe it. And indeed, everything at the moment looks like the world will break through 1.5 on a permanent basis and beyond. And where we end up, I don't know. But the precise point is that the global climate is like the proverbial oil tanker. It takes a long time to turn around. The ice, for example, in the Arctic and Antarctic will continue to melt even if they had no net CO2 emissions. It would continue to melt for at least the next 100 years, which will then add to the momentum of increased climate temperatures on average. Okay. Moving on, I thought it was just worthwhile in the last few minutes to comment. I did watch it. I watched the first time I've ever seen a Tucker Carlson interview. It's not my sort of TV. He used to be, of course, the anchor man on Fox News, pro-Trump, and all the rest of it. But yeah, there he was interviewing for 2 hours, 5 minutes, 41 seconds. Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin. I have to say, while I admired the time, I did find it very boring. And it was obvious that Tucker Carlson felt intimidated by Putin. And Putin grabbed the interview and said, "Is this an interview or is it a serious discussion?" Within the first few seconds, Tucker replied, "It's a serious discussion." And Vladimir then starts off, I don't know, was it the year 600 AD? He starts off giving him a lecture and all the rest of us in medieval Russian history, the Kingdom of Rus, the Northmen coming in, and basically the myth, because this is sort of myth history. It's a bit like, I can't remember their names, Hengist and Hergist, whatever it was, the first two Saxon kings of England, you know, and talking about Sussex or Kent, I can't remember. Either way, this is schoolbook stuff that kids get taught. It's not real history. So the history is that the people of Rus asked these guys to become their princes. And they said, "Oh, all right, we'll become princes." And they founded this kingdom and it grew and grew. And as more and more people joined, they were so lucky being part of this emerging kingdom of Kiev, and then the kingdom of Moscow, and then the Muscovite kingdom grew and grew and adopted Christ. Anyway, you get the idea. And he went on and on and on. And basically, this is part of, I've read it, the Putin essay that he produced after the February the 22nd so-called special military operation, basically arguing that Ukraine wasn't a legitimate state, that it was established when it was, in terms of its origins, it was part of the Rus people. Those big chunks of it were given away. I don't know why, by Lenin and the Bolsheviks to the new Soviet Republic of Ukraine. Khrushchev then gave the Crimea. What's Crimea got to do with Ukraine? Quite rightly, very little, except in terms of it's at the bottom of it. But anyway, the point would be, from our point of view, whatever the ins and outs of the borders of Ukraine, the point that would matter to us is what people think. And that is the most important thing. So history matters, but we don't have a view of what is a legitimate nation and what's an illegitimate nation. If people think themselves that they're part of a nation, we need to take account of that. And of course, that applies within Ukraine as well. The Russians in Ukraine, if they feel Russian, that ought to be taken into account. So, of course, what we have is a West, what we have is a Zelensky government that says, no, they're just Ukrainians. Well, they aren't. Either way, what we had is a very long, not discussion, lecture. I would say, with a few questions by Tucker thrown in. He tried to get his moment of glory, taking back this American journalist that's in prison in Russia at the moment, charged with spying. Putin said, "I'll exchange him for somebody who's in prison at the moment in Germany," but he didn't get his moment of flying on the jet back home to glory. Notably, in my view, all the Fed questions from Tucker Carlson trying to get Putin to back Trump were all rejected. Basically, Putin said, "Look, it doesn't really matter who's president of the United States," which interested me. What matters is what the elite in the United States think. So it doesn't matter whether you've, that was the implication I drew from it. It doesn't matter whether you've got Putin or Trump, you've got the same American foreign policy. That was his argument, not my argument. So I found that interesting. But yeah, 2 hours, 5 minutes, 41 seconds. We've got a valiant comrade who's going to do an article on it. All I would say is that the press commentary, the media commentary on it is just stupid. You know, crazy Putin. He didn't come over as crazy. He didn't come over, he's on his deathbed. He didn't come over that he was using a body double and all this sort of type stuff. He came over as perfectly sane, perfectly calm, and perfectly calculated. That was my impression. So the response to him is just ridiculous. And also, what I would say is, what a contrast. However much he took command of this discussion, what a contrast it is to the usual BBC stuff with Andrew Neil, or is that he's on some other station I know now, of where it's your job to interrupt every 2 seconds. So you can't even get an answer out before someone asking another question. I mean, Putin was interesting because, having delivered a lecture for a quarter of an hour, and Tucker's basically going, Jesus Christ, try to steer him off somewhere. Now he said, look, I haven't made my point yet. Let's go back to 600 again, or 1100. A complete contrast to the imbecility of normal Western, the Western media, where it seems to be the job of the media to do down the bourgeois politicians, to make them know that they're vulnerable to press and media attack. We can make you and we can break you. Just a comment on that. Remember Red Ed? They broke him. Right? Remember Jeremy Corbyn? They broke him. Why aren't they doing the same with Starmer, who in his youth was a member of the Trotskyist infiltration organization called Socialist Alternatives, was a Pavloite who infiltrated communist parties or social democratic parties? Why aren't they calling him Red Kit? He's even got the name of this left labor hero. Either way, the point that's I'm making is at the moment they aren't doing that, but they could if Sir Keir got bolshy, to use a phrase. Okay. Sticking with America, this is almost an Albanian result, isn't it? In Nevada, Trump, this is the Republican caucus. I've got to get my American politics right. Caucus, where you go along to your town hall or your school hall meeting, you vote in person. That's my understanding of a caucus as opposed to a primary. A primary is where you register as a Democrat or Republican. I think you also can be an independent. I don't know. We've got Americans here who can put the limey right here. But you go along to the ballot box, you put your name next to a candidate. And yeah, we've got the chair. I'm a Yankee, and I'm going to pick you. Limey's right, but you put your ex next to the candidate, and that's the result. So obviously, one would expect more of a turnout, more participation with a primary than you would with a caucus. Either way, what we had in Nevada is Nikki Haley basically decided it wasn't worth it. It wasn't worth the $55,000 to put herself on the ticket. So she didn't put herself on the ticket. So there was Trump and somebody called, who I don't care who what he was called, Ryan Binkley. You won't hear of him ever again, I suspect, unless he assassinates someone. He'll disappear from history. But Trump got 99% of the vote. So that's why I mean an Albanian result. Maybe Enver Hoxha got 100%. I don't know. Either way, 99% of the 60,000 voters went with Trump. That means he gets the 26 delegates for the Republican National Convention. I think that's July. At the moment, he looks on dead on course for that. And the projections are that in South Carolina, I think I'm right, which is the next primary, which is where Nikki Haley used to be governor. She's looking like, according to the polls, she's going to lose big time, which would be, I think, she's already lost it, surely, but it surely would be the final nail in the coffin of the Nikki Haley campaign. And then who do you have? I mean, so you have this weird, weird situation of someone who's got four criminal trials, leave aside the civil ones, four criminal trials pending. Someone who could possibly, he'll do his best not to, could possibly be a convicted felon being elected president of the United States. What the hell happens? I mean, I haven't got a clue, but the idea that nothing happens, I find not credible. We already heard from Trump, I'll only be a dictator on day one. Well, I take that seriously, except I don't take the day one seriously. Precisely what I would expect on some sort of not, 100%, but I'll put odds on it sort of type idea, is the Democrats, the Army, Chief of Staff, CIA, I don't know what, acting to save democracy from democracy. I mean, I don't know that it's going to happen. But if it happened, I would turn around and say, told you so. What the hell that means in terms of the international order, the post-World War II architecture, what it means to the ideology of bourgeois democracy, which I always have considered to be an oxymoron. The capitalist class is not a democratic class, it's an anti a democratic class, but it is a class that can fool some of the people some of the time. And that's where you get bourgeois politics from. Either way, the United States is going somewhere fast. And meanwhile, of course, what you get is Trump being described on the basis of not prosecuting him for having secret documents at home. Him being described as a well-meaning old man who's forgetful. And you couldn't make it up, could you? Yes, he was angry, and I sort of understand that. I can't, you couldn't remember the day that his son died. I damn well could. But then, to compound it, if you go in front of the cameras, with a vindication, I'm sharp as a, whatever people are sharp with. And then you fluff it by naming Sissy. See, I could get done for being old and infirm and my memory's going. But Sissy, as the president of Mexico, wow. So what the hell do they do with Joe Biden? Do they change horses? Well, if they change horses to, what's the name, Harris. The polls at least indicate not Harris winning, but Trump big time winning. So, to me at least, the odds are on, bar what I've already said about the state and the Democrats acting. It looks like we're at least going in the direction, because what other possibilities are there of a Trump second term? Just on impaired facilities, by the way, there's been stuff, and I've already indicated this with the Putin interview. I don't buy into the idea, because you fluff Sisi in Egypt, that what that means is you accidentally hit the the nuclear button because you've forgotten. If a president was in that sort of state, they would come in and say, we're taking you aside, Mr. President. The president is a powerful position, but clearly works on the basis of being surrounded by advisors who are all powerful people, precisely as Putin was indicating. And Putin shouldn't be thought of just some crazy dictator. He represents the FSB, the state. He represents the elite. And we need to understand that. So, again, if we look back at British history, I mean, you had crazy King Charles, not Charles, King George III, for example, the guy who was meant to have lost America. Well, he didn't lose America, did he? You know? We also have, if you want to go back into history, what's his name? Charles VI of France, who believed that he was glass and he could be shattered. Before that, again, I think a lot of it was made up propaganda. We all know the stories of Caligula making his horse a senator, etc., etc., etc. So the fact that the Biden and his advisors, or Biden, has thought it's advisable to come out fighting on the fact that he doesn't make fluffies was stupid. He really should not worry about it. Note with Trump, he makes all sorts of fluffs all the time, but simply rides roughshod over it. So the fact that Biden has made it into an issue is clearly a weak point, and it has strengthened clearly Trump's hand. Anyway, that's just a comment really on the nature of presidents and kings. They do matter, but not as much as we're often told.